A while back, Yoram and I went to the Herzliya conference on the media as a theater of war, the blogosphere, and the global battle for civil society. It was a two-day conference, and we did a number of interviews for some of the participants. And so, and here they are, the participants, the interviews, and our commentary at the end of the interviews on our way back from Herzliya to Tel Aviv.
Hi, Maya. Could you tell me a little bit about why, what you do and why you're here at this conference?
Sure. My name is Maya Kortoru. I work for United Israel Appeal of Canada for the Public Relations and Marketing Department. And I'm here to learn about the media and how it covered the Second Lebanon War and how we can, what sort of lessons we can learn from it.
Is it, do you feel, or does your organization feel that the questions being asked here are significant for the Canadians?
Yes, especially since our involvement with like the AIPAC of Canada. We really want to know what's going on here and how we can help.
Thank you. Your name?
Hadass.
Hadass. Can you tell me how you come to be here and what it means for you?
Yeah, I'm a freelance journalist in Israel, and I'm just interested in the media, and I basically just came out of interest to learn more. I've been to a few other conferences similar. You can never learn enough about the conflict and hear what people have to say. So.
I don't hear a Canadian accent. Where are you from?
I went to school in Boston, so I'm American.
Then we talked to Nidra Poller. She has just given a presentation in the panel Coverage of the Lebanese War, Western Media, from her vantage point of Paris, where she'd been living since 1972. And then we were visited by Ronan Gissin, the former advisor to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon.
We enjoyed very much your presentation. I'm wondering if we could ask you a few questions.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you if you could expand on your statement about the evil in the heart of Europe.
Yes.
Thank you.
Courage and presentation.
You remind me of another
woman that I knew and which the Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, when I was his advisor, knew her, Oriana Fallaci. She was a very courageous woman. And I admire your courage because I know how difficult it is to say what you said in that kind of environment. And I know Charles Anderlein personally. He used to be in my unit, in the spokesman unit. That was before he was converted to Pollywood. When he first operated in our capacity, he did good things for France 2 in 1982, and he was a real Zionist. But something happened on the way. His mother-in-law, Annick Rigal, she never changed. She always stood up for Israel. Annick Rigal was a philosopher, a friend of Raymond Aron in France. And she wrote the book Israeli Le Coupable in 1982, standing up for Israel. Again, a very singular voice.
You know, he just did a book on the lost years. And you know what he did? It's about the Al-Aqsa. I call it Jihad Intifada. You know what he did?
He's been funded by Arafat people for many years.
He puts the book 2001 to 2006 because he can't talk about Al-Dur affair anymore. So he has to start it later.
And
well,
I
listen,
you,
we're both boxers, I can see that.
What?
We're both boxers.
Yeah, see, they asked me where you learned English. English I learned in high school in Israel, but street fighting I learned in the streets of Brooklyn. That's where I was raised. So I'm a street fighter. I'm not a spokesman. That's why the cab driver remember, you're the guy that says, you know, they remember two things. They said, you're the guy with the big eyebrows that says, don't mess with us. I said, that's me?
Maybe we could return to my question about the evil in the heart of...
In the heart of Europe, right. Because, you see, what I observed, listening to the spokespeople, is that, and it breaks my heart, because Israelis are so good, such decent people, fair-minded, careful of life. And they're talking to cynical people who have lost their souls. And when you talk to people like that, and you say to them, I'm sorry... They say, oh, okay, so I can destroy you. I can exterminate you. I'm not guilty. You are. You mustn't ever say that to them. You cannot speak to Europeans the way you speak to Americans. They are not the same kind of people. And you have to know what kind of people they are. You have to know the compromises that they're making. The way that they're afraid of the Muslims in their own country. But it's not only their fear. It's that they haven't gotten over. They pretend to cry about the Shoah, but they have not gotten over it. And so in order not to have to do something about it, they are starting this new game. If they can kill the Jews again, then it was all right the other time, right? It's not that they're apologetic or feel guilty. They want to do it again. This is a sickness in Europeans.
Thank you very much.
Then we talked with Judith Weiss from Kesher Talk. She was part of the panel called The New Kid on the Block, Blogosphere and the Mainstream Media. Do you, for instance, do you consider yourself on one side or the other of the left-right division?
I call myself a hawkish liberal. I'm sort of hawkish liberal.
Can I offer the thought of a radical centrist?
Well, I don't know if that describes it, because I'm very definitely very hawkish on foreign policy, but I'm very liberal on domestic social issues. But economically, I'm more of a libertarian. But there are an awful lot of people like me out there, and we don't fit into any of the categories. So
we have to organize. We have to give a name in an organizational context.
Well, we've been working. There are like bunches of us, and we keep trying to figure out what to call ourselves. And you know, so.
Thank you, Judith. Judith Weiss. One of the people who spoke at the conference was Michael Totten. He has a blog called Middle East Journal. I've heard that he's one of the few bloggers who supports himself blogging. And he's also a journalist. He decided to come and live in Lebanon, in Beirut at some point, in order to pursue his journalistic aspirations. He wasn't working for any particular newspaper, and he went there, he rented an apartment, he started living there, and he brought the conference some interesting insights into Lebanon and the reaction of the people during the time of the war. I'm curious, Michael, which organizations do you write for, and what are the reactions to what you're saying?
I've written for a couple of different newspapers and magazines. I actually don't get a lot of reaction from them. I get far more feedback on what I write when I write on my own blog, because I've got an open comments section. It is my name. It is michaeltotten.com.
What are the comments?
Oh, well, mostly supportive, but... You know, it also depends on what kind of attention I'm getting that day and from where. If I actually read all these responses and they're critical, it forces me to think, you know, about what I have written and what I think and maybe why. Even if the commenters are wrong, they do, or if in my opinion they're wrong, they'll force me to sharpen my thinking somewhat. And sometimes people do know more than I do about something. I mean, whenever I write about Lebanon, I'll get a lot of Lebanese commenters. Who, of course, know more about the country than I do. They're Lebanese, and I'm not. And sometimes they're crazy, and sometimes they aren't, and sometimes I learn something from them.
How did you come to choose Lebanon as an area to specialize in?
Well, partly because it's the place, because I rented an apartment there, and I wanted to travel around and visit various places in the Middle East, and it's the only place, either Beirut or Tel Aviv, really the only cities in the Middle East that I would find acceptable to live in. Because I'm certainly not going to live in Egypt, or God forbid, Syria, or Jordan. I'd just be bored out of my mind in Jordan. So really, I mean, Lebanon, it's Beirut anyway, is a nice place, and it appeals to me very much. And there was a lot of drama there, too.
Could you encapsulate again some of your insights about the communities in Lebanon and how they relate to each other?
Well, you could think there are 18 different communities in Lebanon. The way to think about the majority is that there are three. There are Sunnis, there are Christians, and there are Shias. And they do not think of themselves as Christians and Muslims. They think of themselves as Christians, Sunnis, and Shias. And they're more or less a third of the country each. And they have a national pact where the Christians have the presidency, the Sunnis have the prime ministership, and the Shia have the Speaker of Parliament. And that power is to be shared among these three communities. And that if any one community tries to dominate the others or to take over the country and hijack it against the will of the others or impose their will on the country, it's war. And this happens. It happens, unfortunately, fairly regularly in Lebanon. And it almost happened last week. Maybe it was about a millimeter away from civil war last week. And I was supposed to come here for this conference, and I was, for a few days, pretty sure I wasn't going to make it because I was going to just be stuck there. But there's part of this national pact is, well, there's a saying, no victor, no vanquished. Nobody can take over the country. Like the Shia right now through Hezbollah, they can't take over the country. The rest of the country will not tolerate it. They won't let them do it. But likewise, and that's the no victor part of the equation, the no vanquished is that if the Christians and the Sunni and the Druze and all the other small minorities wanted to gang up on Hezbollah and vanquish them, they can't. They can't work because they're a third of the country. They have to live with these people. Like them or not, they're a third of the country, and that's far too large of a percentage to just dismiss and say, to hell with you people.
Do you think Hezbollah was testing the system last week?
No, I don't think so. I think they know the system. They know the system a little bit better than I thought, because it looked like they didn't know the system, because they took downtown, they occupied downtown, they very nearly took the prime minister's office. And the reason they didn't take the prime minister's office, because the prime minister of Fouad Senor said, if you take my office, I cannot control my street. And Hassan Nasrallah knew exactly what that meant. It meant if Hezbollah took the Grand Sarai, that the Sunnis were going to come out of West Beirut with machine guns and really start some serious trouble. And that if he told them not to do it, they'd do it anyway. And I know these people. I know he's right. And Nasrallah knows he's right, too. And so they backed off. They didn't take the prime minister's office. And then they kept threatening to take the airport. Every day for a week, they were threatening to take the airport. And this is when I started to get worried, thinking, oh, God, here we go. Because they're going to take the airport, and it's going to be war. Because that's pushing it. It was too far. And then Nasrallah sort of stopped talking about taking the airport.
Did he blink?
He blinked. He stopped talking about it. He said, we're going to escalate, but he would no longer said what they were going to do. But the airport was suddenly just quietly scuttled. That wasn't going to happen anymore. And then he finally announced what he was going to do, and it was just another rally. It was a rerun. He was stuck in a loop. He knew he went all the way to the brink, and he couldn't do any more except have another rally. Big deal, another rally, right?
At that point, the status quo was, this moment in time, was put back in place.
Yeah, the formula was followed.
So how come the mainstream media just doesn't get it? Is it just laziness?
It depends on... Yeah, it's partly laziness. It's also partly that during a crisis, journalists should pop in and out. I know what it's like to pop in and out of places. I've done it. I do it in Israel. I'm not an authority on Israel. I'm in here for a few days or a week, and then I leave. And so that's what I do here, they do there. And sometimes that's just how it goes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it necessarily, but with an individual who does this, the problem is when 95% of the journalists do this, and they quote each other. And they none of them are experts, and they sort of use each other as their primary knowledge base. And they're all just as ignorant as everybody else. And so it doesn't work very well. No. And there's also the phenomenon which you have with journalists here, foreign correspondents in Israel and Lebanon as well, is there are foreign correspondents in each country who live in these countries and don't really like the country very much.
You should not like Tel Aviv, exactly. I can't imagine.
Well, you know how some of the foreign correspondents here are. Exactly the same people in Lebanon, and they don't like it. They really don't like the place, and because it's, well, like I was saying before, it's too Western, it's too...
Not exotic enough, not romantic enough.
It's too pro-American, it's too European, it's not Arab and authentic enough. And they sneer at the place. And yet they hang out in the Christian side of the city and hang out in the nightclubs with all the hot women. And they're just, the cognitive dissonance with these people must be incredible. But, you know, same with the foreign correspondents here. You know, they'll have a good time in Tel Aviv. They're not going to move to Gaza. They wouldn't live in Gaza, for God's sake, right? It's the same kind of thing.
In Nahariya, because it's closest to Lebanon, they cross the border.
Certainly the UN would do that.
The UN people, a lot of UN people did that. They had a big community up there. Because they had hospitals and they had, you know, all the conveniences.
So what is your experience of Israel?
War. I've spent 5 weeks here and four of them were during war. So that's pretty much it. But I spent most of my time in Tel Aviv and I love Tel Aviv. It's great. It's the second best city in the Middle East. Sorry.
Thanks so much.
I assure you, Ben.
So after the first day of the conference, Yoram and myself took a taxi back to Tel Aviv, and this is the conversation that we had in the cab. So, Yoram, what was your impression of the first day of the conference?
I was happily surprised at some of the interesting insights and thoughts that we heard. I was, again, a little disappointed, as I usually am, in the uniformity of political positioning that most people appear to stand behind. I think
The most interesting things that I heard there were from two gentlemen, neither of whom were even Jewish, much less Israeli, who had both spent time in Lebanon, and who talked about, from their perspective, what's really happening in Lebanon and, by extension, in the Middle East, that the real challenge here, the real conflict, is between the Shiites and the, between Lebanon, for instance, between the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Christians, rather than between the Christians and the Muslims. That, it, particularly in Lebanon, it's seen as at least a three-way split and a three-way conflict. And in those parts of the Middle East, according to what one of the gentlemen said, where you didn't have the large Christian population like you have in Lebanon, the split was really between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and that's really a significant, if not the more significant, conflict. And it's an old conflict. I mean, it's been going on here for a long time. And behind that, the idea that he mentioned about how the Middle East is really made up very much of minorities, and that the minorities are always in a struggle to keep from being absorbed or being destroyed, overwhelmed, and in many cases genocided in the past, I think is something that we need to keep in mind when we try and understand what it is that's going on here where we live, or what it is that's going on there that we're concerned about for those who don't actually live here. And I thought those were very interesting. And then the last section on all the people in the blog business also was quite awakening. And the woman who showed us the slides of the blog of a site that
memorandum.com
memorandum.com that lists by popularity subjects and issues being dealt with on the various blogs. And then Richard, I think he said that before when we interviewed him, talked about how the blogs are an equivalent of sorts to the explosion of print in Europe, at least, and that it really made a real shift in the way information was being shared and the degree to which people felt themselves to be participating in the world, in their societies. And I think that's very important outside of our immediate concerns, our immediate involvement here in Israel, in the Middle East, and so on, but on a planetary level. And the fellow from the Philippines who talked about how that if there are more and more bloggers in Arabic, he felt that the result would be very positive, and that in the blogging system works very much on a Darwinian basis, which is that the people who write the truth get most of the attention, and that people, that the different blogs are successful according to the degree to which they are factual, actual, and are dependable, that their sources and what they say are accurate.
Yeah, so they don't, my take on it as more and more people, like I said, what, 22 million blogs now on the internet, ranging from all areas of interest, and eventually,
if it's important enough, people will comment on it, and if the truth isn't there, then they will be found out and they will lose credibility. And so there's a level of credibility within our world. I mean, we're part of that world. And what's really exciting is that the impact it has on the mainstream media, and it almost keeps them, in a sense, kosher and honest, especially when we, as more and more people are aware that the internet, the blog world exists, and the podcast world exists, and therefore they're always looking there, well, was that true or not true? I mean, almost for certification, in a sense. I was very impressed by Mark Regev. I was impressed because I think he's the new generation after Nissim. I thought that his sensitivity of how to approach the European media, a European public, and speaking in the language in which people identify with and can understand the subtleties of what's being said, and using native speakers to bring across our points, I think is crucial. His openness to listening to some criticism, which I thought was really nice. He wasn't defensive about it, which gives me encouragement. And also the difficulty of trying to get all of this
all of this information together and to line up the IDF, the government, official government, governmental organizations, and who's to represent whom and speak to whom, to the press and so forth, with the onslaught of the lies that are perpetuated on the other side in order to put us in a poor light. How we react to it and how we identify with it and how we coordinate the different agencies in order to address it, I think is really crucial and very difficult one. I think it's more complex than I appreciated previously.
You mentioned the idea of native speakers being engaged in on our side in their countries, and I wanted to mention that the person who talked about that is an official of the institution which sponsored one of the sponsors today, Interdisciplinary Center Herzliya, and that they are, I guess, that they have a fair number of foreign, you mentioned Norwegian and Danish.
600 students from 48 different countries.
And that the encouragement factor there is for those people to go out, to go back to their homes and be able to articulate the position, the Israeli position. And the idea that was mentioned quite often about being more aggressive on Israel and less apologetic, and being on top of things, of having actual amounts to combat videographers. But the Army did that a while ago. To some degree, at least, they went into a program of giving out video cameras to individual soldiers in various units in order to document what's happening from that point of view. Maybe it didn't go as far as in the Lebanon conflict, which was sort of an important subtext here because it's the most recent and in many ways one of the more painful experiences we've had.
I think the point also being made that we should embed, not be afraid to embed journalists, and not be afraid to allow them the opportunity to get a first-hand view of our side from our eyes. And I think that's really crucial. We tend to be a little afraid, rightfully so. We always think it's going to come back to haunt us. But if we're in the right, if we're in the way, and we're doing the right, and we're not intentionally out to do anybody in except to do whatever the goal is to be done, if it's a war, do it right, and don't indiscriminately kill, blah, 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 then there shouldn't be a fear, and it can only speak to the truth. I mean, and I thought that was really articulated very well in a couple of the sessions, not to be afraid to do that. And if that was a criticism of this war, because they were basically reporting from all over Lebanon and from the mountain right on the border of Israel, and never getting to see clearly what was really going on with our soldiers and in regard to Hezbollah and what our soldiers were seeing.
That was a real problem, because the soldiers were actually seeing the military equipment in the middle of civilian areas, and that one fellow who had been in Lebanon talked about how next to Bin Jebel, which was the capital of Hezbollah in South Lebanon, was a Christian village where there weren't any of the Hezbollah fighters. And then when the war started, the Hezbollah fighters moved into the village. Before that, the Hezbollah fighters had been in a valley not far away and kept the villagers out. Once the war started, they actually moved into the village.
And so you've been listening to IsraelScene.com.